You're listening to A Scary State, and this week we're covering Alaska. So, Lauren?
Yes, Nora?
Let's get scary.
All right. Hello, everyone.
Hi, everyone. All right. So, this week we're covering Alaska, and Lauren and I were just chatting about how we're really excited for each of our cases. So, without further ado... Oh, wait. Lauren has an update. Sorry.
Yes. Okay. So, I have a true crime update. All right. So... this was something I'm sure that everyone was aware of. About last year, it hit Netflix and took over the country. Joe Exotic and Tiger King. So he is getting a resentencing.
Really?
So a little background, if you're one of the very few people out of the loop with Tiger King. In 2019, he tried to hire two hitmen to kill his rival, Carol Baskin. He was arrested and sentenced to 22 years. Well, on Wednesday, July 14th, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 19th Circuit ruled to vacate his sentence on a technicality.
What?
So the judge on this case is Gregory A. Phillips. So pretty much his conviction still stands, but there was just an error in the sentencing process. So he was given a longer sentence because the two murder-for-hire counts against him were considered separately instead of together, which they should have been. So he ultimately was convicted of the two counts of murder-for-hire, 8 counts of violating the Lacey Act for falsifying wildlife records, and 9 counts of violating the Endangered Species Act for his mistreatment of animals, which led him to face 262 to 327 months, which is about 21 to 27 years.
Wow.
So his team argued that if his murder for hire charges had been considered together, because they were technically for the same person, so like, you know, they're two separate things, but they were for the same person, so it's like the same thing. He would have only faced 210 to 262 months, which is about 17 and a half to 21 years instead. So they're saying that they should have been considered together. This development in the case comes a day after Nicolas Cage, who is going to play Joe Exotic in a movie, said it won't be happening. So we were going to get a Tiger King movie starring Nicolas Cage, who is Joe's favorite actor.
Oh.
He hates Nicolas Cage,
like,
yeah,
he bothers me.
But so we're not going to get a Tiger King movie. But yeah, so the resentencing will happen a little bit later to see what his actual sentence will be. So when we find that out, we will update on that as well.
Honestly, like, I know that Joe Exotic, you know, the show was so funny and interesting, and, you know, there were sad moments. But at the end of the day, that man is not a good man. He needs to be locked up for a long time. And then he definitely set their office on fire.
Mm-hmm.
He was just horrible to the animals. Like, it was an entertaining show, but like, please never let that man out of jail.
Yeah,
like, he's not gonna do good things when he comes out.
And he thought too that he was gonna get a pardon last year, but that didn't happen. I read somewhere that he thought he was gonna get the pardon, so he literally ordered a limo for himself and like a hairdresser and a makeup artist and everything, and then he didn't get the pardon. So he literally watched the limo drive away.
Well, can't say I feel bad for him.
I know. It's just such a, I don't know.
Ugh,
I don't know.
Gosh.
But yeah, I was looking through the news the other day and I came up again like with that and I was like, oh,
that
I need to cover.
That is so interesting.
So yeah, so we'll find out his sentencing later.
Yeah.
But so now, without further ado, we'll go on to Alaska. So Alaska, nicknamed the Last Frontier, joined the Union on January 3rd, 1959, and became the 49th state in the U.S. It got its name from the Aleut word, Alazak, also Ayeska, which means mainland, which translate to the object towards which the action of the sea is directed.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's deep.
I know. So Alaska has a state dog, the Alaska Husky, and a state fossil, the woolly mammoth. So some weird laws. It is illegal to feed alcoholic beverages to a moose. In Fairbanks, it is illegal to blow a horn in a way that will disrupt the peace. And in Nome, you are not allowed to carry a slingshot. In other parts of Alaska, you can only carry one if you have the proper license to do so. William W. Dalton Highway is one of the most deadly highways in the world, and it is located in Alaska. The road is 414 miles long, or 666 kilometers. This road ends at the community of Dead Horse, and those who are about to travel on this road are encouraged to bring survival gear with them in case something happens. And one of the turns on this road has been nicknamed, quote, Oh Shit Corner. Yeah. This road has also been featured on, like, Deadliest Highways or some show like that, so pretty creepy. So Alaska has over 100,000 glaciers, which cover 5% of the state.
Wow.
Juneau, the capital, is only accessible by boat or by plane. And in Alaska, there are approximately one bear per every 21 people.
Huh.
Barrow? experiences the longest and shortest days. So the sun rises on May 10th. It won't set for close to 3 months. Then when it sets on November 18th, it won't rise for almost 2 months.
Imagine trying to go to sleep and it's day outside.
No.
I would lose my mind.
So you literally have 3 months of day and 2 months of night.
Wow.
Yeah.
That will mess with, like, your psyche.
Yeah. I watched this girl's TikTok where she was like, this is a day in the life of someone in Alaska. And she's like, all right, it's about 11 p.m. and this is what it looks like outside. And it's literally daytime.
That's nuts.
Yeah. And the Iditarod is the state's largest sporting event.
The what?
The Iditarod. The one where, like,
a funny name. I'm sorry. It is.
It is. But yeah, the one where the dogs run.
Oh, what? That's cool.
Yeah, it's super cute. All right, Nora, what are you covering today for Alaska?
Okay, so before we dive into Alaska, can we talk about really, really quick something that happened here in the DC area yesterday?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there was, like, I guess there was two cars outside of the National Stadium. That's baseball, if you don't know sports.
The Nats were playing the Padres.
Yeah. So there were two cars, and there was a shooting. Like, they shot at each other. And two people in the cars were injured. And then one lady who was literally a fan at the stadium got shot. So we're just praying that.
I think I read somewhere that a child might have been killed.
Really?
I don't know if that's right or not.
I hope not.
Yeah.
But I'm just really hoping that, you know, honestly, I hope everyone involved is okay. But I hope that the people shooting at each other get, you know, what they deserve, which is jail time.
And we had a friend. Well, we have a friend who lives right there. Like, you can watch a game from the roof of his building.
That's crazy.
And we asked them, we're like, are you guys okay? They were up at another friend's house, so they were fine, but it's so scary.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm one of those people where I will literally, like, go on and read articles for, like, an hour, mm-hmm. and I, like, saw videos of it, and it was so crazy. People were, like, running for their lives.
Mass shootings, I think, are some of the scariest things.
Yeah, definitely. So just praying that they catch the other car, because one of the cars has not been found.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And so they did catch one, though?
They did. They caught the one where there was two people who were shot because they went to the hospital. Mm. So hopefully they'll fess up, because obviously they very, very, very likely knew who was shooting at them.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't random.
Jeez.
But they're, like, redoing the game today. So
I don't know if I'd want to go.
I know. And, like, the guy announcing, there was, like, a spokesperson. I don't know who he was a spokesperson for. But he was saying, like, this was an isolated incident. Don't be scared to come. But even with that, like, that's scary.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just wanted to acknowledge that. And hopefully, you know, everyone's okay.
Did we mention that it was in D.C.?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's in Navy Yard, which is where the stadium is, like, literally right outside the stadium. So, anywho. All right. So, I'm going to dive into my case for Alaska. So Valerie Sifsoff was a young Native American who was in the Yupik Inupiaq tribe in Alaska.
Wow, I'm very impressed with that.
Thank you. To help you picture Valerie, she was a slight raven-haired woman, and she grew up fishing with her dad, Victor, in Bristol Bay, Alaska's world-class salmon fishery. Fun fact, I wonder if people pronounce it salmon or salmon. Like, I think people in parts...
How do you pronounce
it? Some people in parts of the world pronounce it salmon. I think people in, like, Australia...
Do you say salmon?
I say salmon.
Okay.
But I've heard it be salmon, like, many times.
And it's like, you don't want to correct people, but you're like, is that?
Yeah. You're like, wait, say that again?
I mean, maybe they think we say it wrong.
Exactly. Huh. I think it's perspective, but it sounds weird to us to hear it, you know? So anyways, the family also spent time in the state's interior at the Clear Air Force Base while Victor Sifsoff worked there as a radar technician. After high school, Valerie, known as Val, was independent and free-spirited. Her dad said that she was always so adventurous and carefree, and she just loved getting out and meeting people and having fun. By 2012, Valerie was 43 years old and had made her way back to Alaska after spending some time in Seattle. She had a long-term boyfriend and was living in Anchorage. Valerie wasn't terribly outdoorsy. Her family said that a campsite was about as far as she'd go into the woods.
Okay, I understand that.
Yeah. And she was more likely to be seen wearing heels than hiking boots. I was like, I feel that, Val.
Yep.
That July, Valerie's boyfriend, Elliot Freeberg, managed to convince her to plan a weekend getaway with him at the Granite Creek Campground, just 65 miles southeast of Anchorage. He later said that was something they both looked forward to.
And where was the campground again?
About 65 miles southeast of Anchorage, which is where they lived at the time. The couple drove down from Anchorage in their SUV and settled in at a campsite surrounded by purple wild geraniums and pushki, with the sound of the Granite Creek rushing by, so I'm sure it was just absolutely breathtaking.
Yeah.
And it was early afternoon on July 7th by the time they arrived. Later, Elliot told Valerie's family and police that the couple had had a fight around 2 p.m. because Valerie wanted to start the fire as soon as they got there, and Elliot thought that they should conserve the fuel.
Okay.
So, not like they're fighting over something that would, like, give Elliot motive to hurt her, mm-hmm. like, if that's really what they were fighting about. But despite their quarrel and rainy weather, the couple managed to have a good time. They listened to music on portable speakers, drank Sam Adams light beers, and Glenlivet Scotch whiskey they'd brought. Later that night, it was a party atmosphere at the campground, and around midnight, the two unfortunately started arguing again.
Aww. Sounds like a really great night before.
I know. It's like they turned it to be better, and then at midnight...
Yeah.
I mean, they had been drinking, so I'm sure that didn't help the matters.
Probably not.
Valerie walked off from the campsite in the direction of outhouses and other campsites, according to Elliot. And like I said, she had been drinking and so had he. But he said that she wasn't stumbling and she wasn't slurring her words when she walked off,
mm-hmm.
which I feel like is good for him and bad for him. Because like, if he let her walk away, if she was like really drunk, that would mm-hmm. be bad. But also, like, clearly she wasn't so drunk, you know?
But still being alone is never good.
Yeah, especially at night. She left behind her keys, her ID, her phone, and other belongings, according to Alaska state troopers at the time.
So, like, she's going to come back.
Exactly. Like, she didn't plan to, like, leave. Mm-hmm. She just stormed off in anger, pretty much. Even if Val did bring her phone, though, there was no cell service at the campground.
Yep.
So Elliot later told police that he thought that Valerie had left to cool off, like I said, mm-hmm. like just take a moment. But around 2 a.m., Valerie still hadn't returned. So Elliot said that he walked around the campground loop looking for her because the way the campground laid out was it was like a giant loop.
That literally sounds just like this place Joe and I went camping in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. There were little cabins and there was like a loop that you would walk around and there were cabins like at certain areas. It was really, really cool, but there were no bathrooms in the cabin. Oh. So you had to like go to the porta potties and that was really terrifying. And so we didn't go at night. I just like
yeah.
went behind my car. And because I always have to wake up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was like that there was no cell service. The wood that we were using to make a fire had been wet from the night before, so we couldn't make the fire. Yeah.
See, I'm more of a glamping type of person.
Well, it was like a cute little cabin. Like there was a cabin inside and there was a bunk bed, so that could fit like a couple people. Then there was a little loft upstairs, which could have fit a couple people. You mm-hmm. had to bring your own propane tank. It was like, it was cute.
Oh my gosh. Speaking of bunk beds really quick, Lauren and Joe, like... So when me and her first started hanging out a lot, which was like 6-7 years ago now,
Nora.
I know it's crazy. They would always get stuck in like the crappiest bed situations.
Because our group of friends, we like to go out together, like camping or go into a cabin or something as a group.
Yeah. So they were stuck in the bunk bed. It was just always the most unfortunate situation.
Our first bunk bed we were stuck in was in a room with two other bunk beds. And so we were also with the people who snored, so we got no sleep. And then the second time we got there, we were in another bunk bed up in the creepy room. So I got there a day late because I had work. So Joe got there the day before me and everyone was like chilling or whatever, and they decided to play hide and seek. So they took out the panels in the room we were in and found all these creepy crawl spaces.
No way.
So when we were in the bunk bedroom, it's like 2 a.m. and all these creepy crawl spaces are open. Oh my God, it was terrifying. And then Joe, of course, was like, oh my God, what do you think would be the worst way to die? So then we start talking.
Oh, oh my God.
We started to watch The Gray with, what's his name? Liam Neeson.
Uh-huh.
The one where he like has to fight the wolf. And so Joe's talking about that. Like it was just the creepiest room ever. And so then the next time we all went to the beach, Joe and I actually got a nice room.
Yeah, I was going to say last time I went to the beach with you guys, I was like, Lauren and Joe are getting a bed.
I know.
Because we cannot do this to them again. Like it just can't happen.
Because we got there late because we were picking up the food for the group. And so I was like, if we're picking up the food and getting there late and I don't get a good room.
So anyways, I digress. Okay, so now it's around 2 a.m., Elliot cannot find her. He's looking around for her. Around 4 a.m., he fell asleep.
I'm just gonna say, if I had been camping with Joe and he goes missing, I am not falling asleep.
That is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
If someone... Okay, they have been together for 10 years.
Oh my God.
Yes, this couple has been together for 10 years. you obviously know each other very well. You would think you love each other very deeply. How can you let someone be off for that long? I would have called the police by then.
And I'm also thinking, like, the moment they walked away, I would have, like, you know,
yeah,
followed at least somewhat behind.
Exactly. You know? Or something. And I know every
relationship. And I don't
want to
victim blame. I don't want to do anything like that at all. But,
exactly.
You know.
And I know hindsight's 20/20 and every relationship's different. But how can you fall asleep?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that to me just blows my mind. And again, I'm not, like, placing blame. I'm just saying from my perspective, I could never fall asleep after that.
No.
Elliot said that he thought that possibly she had somehow gotten back to the city and was outside of their apartment.
And how far from the city were they again?
Very far.
Yeah.
She would have had to, I mean, this was 2012, so I don't think there was, like, Uber and things like that yet.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Especially in rural Alaska.
Yeah.
So that is not really an option for her to get back.
Mm-mm.
Spoiler alert, she wasn't back at the apartment.
Yeah, I didn't think she would have been.
So he called Valerie's family shortly after, like, in the morning, and told them that she was missing.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean, like, around 12 o'clock the next day. So Victor told police that he was fishing, and Victor, by the way, is Valerie's dad.
Okay.
He told police that he was fishing out in the bay when he got the call. His wife said, quote, "You've got to come home right now," end quote. He didn't ask any questions. He flew down immediately, and then right away, they went to Granite Creek and started mobilizing a search for her. The weather that week in South Central Alaska was cool and rainy, and Victor worried about whether his daughter was hurt or if she was outside in the cold, exposed to wet, windy weather. He also questioned if she'd had a run-in with someone unknown and had been abducted. He was understandably very shook up, and I just, like, from my view researching this, I feel like it's kind of hard to believe that she got lost or hurt because she's from Alaska. She's, like, she's grown up there. I feel like she, like...
But how in the woods was their camping place, though?
It was very woodsy.
Yeah.
But it wasn't her first time camping, either.
But was it her first time camping there?
No, she had been there.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So it might sound suspicious that Valerie just, like, walked off, but according to Valerie's father, he later told police that it wasn't unusual for them to give each other space after a disagreement. And, like I said, they'd been together over 10 years, so the family knew the boyfriend super well.
Yeah.
But speaking of police, Valerie's boyfriend, Elliot, did not report her missing until 3 days later.
Oh. So a very concerned boyfriend.
Right. 72 hours. He did not tell police that she was missing.
We're really shit-talking him, and I don't know what happens with him yet, so I'm sorry.
I mean, I'm just, like, giving the facts. This is, like, how long it took.
Yeah. Which, in my humble opinion, I think is just a really long time.
A very long time.
Like three days.
The longest 3 days of your life.
Yeah.
And Elliot said he doesn't really know why he didn't contact police earlier, but he wishes he had. Tears filled his eyes when he was talking about how long Valerie had been missing. And Valerie's dad, Victor, later said that the fact that Elliot waited to call police had been hard for him and a lot of people to, like, grasp or to understand.
Yeah.
But he said Elliot seemed sincere, and he wanted to keep Elliot close and help to look for Valerie. Sergeant Zweifel, who was assigned to the case, said the delay clearly hurt the search, and he said that it really put them, like, behind in the game of finding her.
Because it's that first 48-hour thing.
Exactly. There's literally a show.
Yeah, exactly.
And he said, "We don't have anything that's fresh out there right now because it's been days."
Mm-hmm.
And
the weather conditions probably didn't help at all.
Exactly. And Valerie's family and, in time, law enforcement, in time, because it took law enforcement, like, a little bit. Mm-hmm. I didn't get the exact date of when they really entered the search, but they did not rush at first. And the military and volunteers searched by ground, air, and in the nearby river for Valerie, and they used ATVs, dogs, and helicopters to search for her.
Dang.
They followed up on every clue that came up and walked miles and miles on the roads looking for where she might have gotten hurt or lost in the woods. Her boyfriend, Elliot, her dad, and brothers walked every square mile of that area. And looking back, he said that at the time, he wished more could have been done. You know, and initially, he was pretty upset because when you have, like, a daughter missing, you want everybody there now searching. And he strongly believed that it took a while for them to get organized, and he was super upset about that. But he says that overall, he believes police did the best that they could with what they had.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I get that, like, mixed feeling of, like, being super frustrated that more isn't done, but they are in rural Alaska.
Yeah.
It's sad that the police didn't send people from other areas when there's a missing person.
If they even could have.
Yeah. We don't know those details, but it's just sad. So they didn't have a lot of officers in the area, and they had to cover hundreds of square miles with just a little bit of police officers. Yeah. So the family continued searching despite their scarce resources, and friends and strangers donated food and supplies and their time to help, which was super nice.
Yeah.
The community came together because they didn't have enough law enforcement helping. Family members and volunteers walked shoulder to shoulder through thick, tall bushes. They swept the area, and Victor carried a 3-ring binder filled with maps documenting the search and a spreadsheet of reports.
Aww.
He literally was doing so much. Like, I feel so
literally all he can do.
Yeah. After several weeks of searching, a green shirt and a black DKNY hoodie were recovered by Valerie's family at the edge of 6 Mile Creek, which was right by the campground that Valerie and her boyfriend were staying.
Oh, no.
And these were the same pieces of clothing Valerie was seen wearing the day she disappeared.
Oh, no.
The family called troopers, and the troopers arrived and took the articles of clothing back with them and then searched the area a bit, but unfortunately they didn't find anything else. The clothing items were later tested for DNA, and one of them came back as a match to Valerie.
Mm-hmm.
Later in August, a kayaker found a shirt in the same area of 6 Mile Creek, and it was later determined to be Valerie's. I don't know if this was, like, the same shirt that mm-hmm. they found earlier, because it seemed like the time was a little bit off, like it was a little later, but it could have been the same shirt.
Yeah.
But either way, her dad, Victor, being a fisherman, knew from searches in the water for other people that sometimes clothing gets pulled off of bodies by the current when people drown. He described finding her clothing like a stab to the heart.
Aww.
After considering multiple possibilities, including that his daughter had walked away and traveled somewhere else or that someone had kidnapped her, Victor was now, after finding the shirt, convinced that his daughter had passed away.
Yeah.
And that it was a place and not a person that killed her. He now strongly believed that she fell into the water. And after all, it was a swift creek and most people wouldn't be able to get out if they fell in.
Oh.
And Valerie was planning her sister's baby shower prior to her disappearance. So her brother doubted that she would have ever run off or tried to hurt herself.
Yeah.
And he said that she must be somewhere against her will if she had disappeared and mm-hmm. was still alive or somewhere else, because there was no way she would drop the ball in the baby shower.
Yeah.
And by the way, they did cancel the baby shower.
Oh.
Yeah. So shortly after Valerie's green shirt was found, the area was hit by super heavy rains. That means that they had to put their search efforts on hold for their own safety and wait it out. The creeks became dangerously high because of the rain, so they just couldn't risk it.
Yeah.
The family kept searching after the heavy rain passed, but, I mean, by then, any evidence was completely gone. And after 4 years of searching, a presumptive death.
4 years?
Yes, 4 years.
Oh, my gosh.
A presumptive death was granted for Valerie in 2016, and to this date, her body has never been found.
Jeez.
Crazy.
Okay, I need to look something up.
Sure.
And you said it was in the Gulf of Alaska near there?
I think so.
Interesting. That'll come back in my story.
Huh, interesting. So according to the FBI's National Crime Information Center, there are currently 1,500 unsolved cases of missing or murdered Indigenous women in the U.S.
Wow.
And 300 of those cases are in Alaska, which
is why. I knew it was a high number, but I didn't know it was that much.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted to cover this case, was because there was a lot of stories when I was researching about, like, stories like this, but all different. In all cases that were either unsolved or they were all devastating.
Yeah.
On top of that, Alaska has one of the highest rates of violence against women.
I have heard that.
Mm-hmm. And there is a really heavy drug issue there.
Yep.
That's a side note. An organization called the Operation Lady Justice Task Force created cold case offices throughout the nation to help solve these cold cases. And Tara Sweeney, the Department of Interior's Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, just opened the Anchorage office for this task force last year.
Nice.
In 2020.
Yeah.
Sweeney said she recently went through the database and could identify by last names alone where in Alaska the missing women came from or family members that she personally knew. She said that That alone is testament that there are so many Alaska Natives that are impacted because of this issue.
Jeez.
When asked what success in this initiative looks like, Sweeney responded that justice for victims and resolution and closure for families is what success looks like.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a special agent in charge of the Anchorage office and investigators, but overall it would be a multidisciplinary team, which will include folks from all the different law enforcement agencies, the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, as well as state and local partners. Sweeney added that the duties for the cold case officers will be to gather intelligence on missing and murder cases, prioritizing these cases for assignment to investigative teams, and develop plans to help guide investigators. I know this case doesn't have, like, any resolution, but I wanted to talk about it because I do think it's great that Alaska and, you know, the government is doing something to help find these 1,500 women.
Definitely.
Or solve their cases in the cold cases. And then also, I mean, Alaska has such a high rate of domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that her boyfriend did it at all. But I do think that there's a lot of things that don't add up in this story.
Yeah.
Including, you know, he's the only one who has accounts of that night.
Yep.
So it's all what he says.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he was able to go to sleep, the fact that he waited days, I want to ask him why. Why did you do that? Why did you wait? It just doesn't make sense to me. And it seems like when he was asked those questions, he didn't have answers. So I don't know if he wasn't pushed hard enough. I don't know. I feel like her dad doesn't want to believe that he could have done something to her.
I get that.
But I feel like he should have been pressured more.
Oh, definitely. But you're the only one who has accounts of what happened.
Exactly. And I was just listening to Crime Junkie like a week ago. And one of their recent cases is about Indigenous women. So that kind of also pushed me to doing this. And yeah, it's just, it's sad, but it's good to talk about.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Dang.
Hey everyone. Have you ever had the idea to start your own podcast, but had no idea where to start? We had no idea either until we found Buzzsprout.
It is hands down the easiest and best way to launch, promote, and track your podcast. Buzzsprout has made our experience with podcasting both fun and stress-free by listing our show on all major podcast platforms like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, just to name a few.
You'll get a great-looking podcast website, audio players that you can drop into other websites, detailed analytics to see how and where people are listening, tools to promote your episodes, and much more.
Following the link in the show notes, lets Buzzsprout know we sent you, gets you a $20 Amazon gift card if you sign up for a paid plan, and help support our show.
Join over 100,000 podcasters already using Buzzsprout.
And remember to stay scary.
Stay safe.
Okay, so this week, you've heard about the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah.
The Bridgewater Triangle.
Uh-huh.
And all the other mysterious triangles around the world.
Uh-huh.
But today I'm going to talk about one located right in Alaska. So located in the area that stretches from Utqiagvik, formerly known as the Barrow, to Anchorage to Juneau, lays an area known as Alaska's Bermuda Triangle.
Wait, can you please play? She played it to see how to pronounce it, and I was almost in tears.
Okay, because see, I promise you, when I tell you we listen to things.
Yes.
All right, let me play this. It's a YouTube video, literally, how to pronounce this word by, who posted this? Learn It with Radhika. All right, let's see if you can hear this.
Utqiagvik.
So that's where I learned how to pronounce this word.
Love it.
Okay. All right, so this area includes unexplored wilderness, seemingly never-ending forests, icy mountains, and chilling and desolate tundras. But this area also includes a very high number of missing persons. This area was first brought into public focus in 1972 when U.S. House Majority Leader Hale Boggs' airplane completely vanished somewhere in this triangle between Anchorage and Juneau. Alaska Representative Nick Begich and aide Russell Brown and their bush pilot Don Johns were also aboard the plane. Don Johns.
What a sad name.
I know. This led to one of the states and one of the country's largest search and rescue operations ever. 400 aircrafts, including 40 military aircrafts and 50 civilian planes, and dozens of boats, including 12 from the Coast Guard, were used to search an area of 32,000 square miles, which is a little bit bigger than the size of the state of Maine. So Maine is only 30,865 square miles. Mm-hmm. This area they were searching was 32,000 square miles.
Wow.
The search lasted an exhausting 39 days, but not a single piece of evidence was found. Not a single piece. Dang. Some people believe that this disappearance was some sort of conspiracy theory, saying that the whole thing was either orchestrated or at least covered up by J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI at the time, due to intense power struggles he had with Boggs. So, fun fact, or maybe interesting fact, this incident led to Congress passing a law that mandated that emergency locator transmitters be installed in all U.S. civilian aircrafts. So I think that's like the black box they have in airplanes.
Yeah.
So since 1988... a staggering 16,000 people have disappeared within the Alaskan Triangle. Wow. And the reason I asked you where it was because southeast of Anchorage mm-hmm. is part of it is in the Alaskan Triangle.
Huh.
Yeah, so that's why I was wondering if it was in the same area. So in 2007, 2,833 people were reported missing, which is huge compared to the low population of Alaska.
So many people.
Mm-hmm. And the population of Alaska at the time was about 670,000. So this equates to about 4 in every 1,000 people going missing. Mm-hmm. Alaska also has the highest number of missing persons who have never been found. In any given year, about 500 to 2,000 people go missing in Alaska.
That is terrifying.
Mm-hmm. There are a few other aircrafts that have completely vanished in this area. In 1950, a military aircraft carrying 44 passengers completely disappeared. In 1990, a Cessna 340 carrying 5 passengers, including the pilot, also completely vanished. Mm. This is definitely not all, but a couple of the more well-known ones. Mm-hmm. So what could account for this unusually high number of disappearances? Obviously, it could be the rough terrain as one highly plausible reason. One accident happened in Argentina, which could help explain the rough terrain idea. Mm-hmm. So Stardust, a Lancastrian 3 airliner with British South American Airways, disappeared in 1947 when it left Buenos Aires, Argentina, heading towards Santiago, Chile. So I looked it up because, like, you think of Argentina, you don't think there's, like, snow or anything.
Yeah.
But there is. They have glaciers, really? Apparently. That's what the internet said. So if I'm wrong, then I looked at a bad internet web thing. So for 50 years, no one knew what happened to those aboard.
Wait, can I just say something else about Argentina?
No.
Okay, well, I know. It is – okay, so my old boss was from there, and she told me that in order to go from the north – like the most northern part to the most southern part, it takes like 12 hours. It's a super long
Jeez.
Country. Yeah.
You never think about that.
I know.
Driving from the very top of Virginia down to the very bottom of Virginia takes over 5 hours.
Yeah.
That's
exactly.
Crazy.
Or even, I don't know how long it takes to get from Northern to Southern California, but I know,
oh
it's,
my gosh.
I mean, it's completely different weather, so
yeah.
That's telling.
That's crazy to think about. But so for 50 years, no one knew what happened to those aboard the Stardust. But in 1998, two climbers from Argentina were ascending Mount Topongato in Argentina and found the wreckage from that plane. It's believed that the plane had crashed into a vertical glacier, which caused an avalanche, which then buried the plane. All in a matter of minutes.
Jeez.
And yes, like I said, Argentina has glaciers. So this could account for some of the plane disappearances, as glaciers are huge and are not actually just solid ice. They're honeycombed and have many hidden chambers and crevices within them. Some of these chambers or crevices could fit a whole house inside. That's how big they are.
Wow.
Yeah. So many planes and even people have gotten lost in these glaciers and were just buried by nature, which is a creepy term.
So creepy.
So the Alaska Triangle also happens to cover a large amount of unexplored wilderness, not even touched by humans. So this rugged terrain houses many potential dangers, such as active volcanoes, harsh weather, and wild animals, just to name a few. Commonly, many people will come out here to camp, but are sadly incredibly underprepared. So this is the case of what happened to McCandles, the subject of the book Into the Wild, written by John... Have you seen
it? Yeah, I've read it and
seen
it.
Oh, you have?
I had to read it in school.
I haven't.
It's so good.
Oh, wow. So it was written by John Krakauer. Mm-hmm. Is that the way you read it?
Krakauer or something.
Yeah. This later became a movie starring Emily Hirsch.
Yep.
But pretty much, Christopher Johnson McCandles went camping in the Alaskan wilderness and disappeared. His body was found a month later by moose hunters. He had starved to death, having not been properly prepared for the reality of camping in Alaska. So the little blurb about it that I read about what happened to him, it was very scary, sad, and really intense.
Wow.
Did I miss anything with that?
No.
Yeah,
I mean,
so that's pretty much what happened.
Yeah, and you know, he's from Arlington.
Oh my gosh, I did not know that at all.
He, like, wanted to abandon his life here and just went to Alaska, and yeah, basically what you said.
Dang.
Yeah.
So others who have just disappeared altogether. Michael Lemaitre entered into the popular Mount Marathon race that takes place annually in Seward, Alaska. It is a 3-mile trail that includes over 3,000 feet of elevation changes. In order to even be put into the race, you have to be entered into a very competitive lottery. So Lemaitre was in pretty good shape, but was a lot older than the other racers. He was last seen when he was only 200 feet below the mountain peak. Race officials were packing up but encouraged him to finish, knowing that they would soon see him as he made his way back down the mountain, because mm-hmm. he was only 200 feet from the top.
Right.
He was never seen again, and no trace of him has been
found.
Where did
he go?
I don't know. So it just goes to show how easy it is to disappear into the wilderness.
Heck?
Yeah, literally they saw him. He had 200 feet to go.
And where, like, his body would have to be somewhere close.
Just That's completely crazy. Disappeared.
By the way, really quick, look at Argentina on a map. Look how, like, that's the equator. It is literally basically in
that
Antarctica.
Is far down. Oh,
everyone,
my gosh.
At home, look at Argentina on a map.
So that's probably where the glaciers are.
That's insane.
Dang.
I never thought about that. Sorry.
I really
my mind
either.
Is blown.
Yeah. So another theory is the existence of ley lines or viral vortexes. Ivan T. Sanderson, an American researcher and cryptozoologist, explains that ley lines, quote, exhibit extreme electric, magnetic, and electromagnetic anomalies, as well as energy vortexes, which are theorized subterranean electromagnetic currents.
Hmm.
So think Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah.
It's also said that famous places like Easter Island, Stonehenge, and the Egyptian pyramids all lay over these vortexes. And they were built in these locations in the first place because of the energy that the vortexes have.
Wow.
Or at least that's the thought. These vortexes are always related to all sorts of paranormal and unexplained things. So they're said to affect humans in many different physical, mental, and emotional ways, such as causing someone to experience visions, showing crazy healing powers, experiencing epiphanies. The list just goes on.
Ooh.
Some say that they are able to tap into their higher selves when around ley lines. Places that are said to have ley lines can induce confusion, disorientation, nausea, and hallucinations. They also cause electrical equipment to malfunction and go haywire.
Oh,
so when we would go to, like, do investigations or something, mm-hmm. we would have to see, like, if our equipment's acting up in a certain area we're in, because it could be the electrical wires, it could be, you know,
yeah.
all this weird stuff, and we would always call it ley lines. I know it's not exactly this, but that's what we would call it. Others have said that the areas that have ley lines are actually doorways and portals to other dimensions and even other realms. So I also learned that there are good vortexes that spin one way. These are the ones that provide healing, good visions, kind of all that stuff. And then there are bad vortexes which spin the other way, and that's what causes disorientation, confusion, you know,
Whoa.
All that bad stuff. So some signs may point to Alaska having some of these vortexes. There is some magnetic anomaly in Alaska that sometimes messes with compasses, so much so that they're as much as 30 degrees off, which is crazy.
That's probably why people get lost
uh-huh.
if they're following a compass.
And it's all in that little Alaska Bermuda
wow.
Triangle area. Some search and rescuers have also reported that they have experienced audio hallucinations while near this triangle. They report that they have heard the sound. They have heard a sound that sounds like an angry swarm of bees. They have also felt disoriented, dizzy, and lightheaded. Readings have also reported higher than average spikes in electromagnetic activity. So could these disappearances be because of ley lines?
Maybe.
Some believe that these disappearances are caused by mythical shape-shifting creatures named the Kushtaka. So the Kushtaka come from the stories of the Tlingit and Tsimshian Indians who are indigenous to southeastern Alaska. The Kushtaka roughly translates to land otter man, which reminded me of Man Bear Pig from South Park. And so it's known more or less as the Bigfoot of the Alaskan Triangle. It was the Tlingit's way of describing this Bigfoot type of creature. So if you look at a Bigfoot and an otter, they kind of have similar characteristics.
Yeah.
They have small ears. They can stand upright. They have opposable thumbs. Environmentally, they live near the water. So it was a video I watched was describing, like, if you're trying to look at Bigfoot and you're trying to look at an otter, if you're trying to describe what Bigfoot looks to someone, an otter is going to be your closest,
wow.
you know, kind of thing. So that's why it's the land otter man. So these shapeshifters are able to assume a human form, the form of an otter, or any other form that will attract lost travelers to them. So there are many, many different stories about these creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Some stories claim that the Kushtakas are friendly and helpful and are known to save those lost in the woods to save them from freezing to death. Some claim that they will distract the lost person by showing them illusions of their family and friends. While the person is distracted, the Kushtaka turn the human into one of them, which then allows the person to survive the cold Alaska weather.
So they're nice little fellas.
Well,
kind of.
There
oh,
are
no.
some stories
oh, no.
that claim that they're evil.
Oh, gosh.
And like to trick and lure sailors to their death.
Ugh.
They're also said to be attracted to lost travelers. Once they spot a lost traveler, they lure them in, lead them through the woods, resulting in the traveler becoming even more lost or disoriented. Other stories have a similar feel, but instead, they imitate the cries of a baby or the screams of a woman in trouble in order to lure travelers to the river. At the river, they either kill the person or turn them into a kushtaka.
That's horrible.
I know. It's also said that some of them try to steal your soul. Huh. So, you know. But you can protect yourself from them by using urine, copper, dogs, and in some cases, fire.
Garlic?
Not garlic in this one. Oh, okay. These creatures also make their presence known by emitting a high-pitched, three-part whistle in the pattern of low, high, low.
Can I do it?
Yeah.
Low, high, low?
Uh-huh.
Hold on.
Yeah, probably. I was literally going to have Joe or Jared make this whistle, and then I forgot. And then Jared's not here, and Joe's injured, so that didn't work either.
Oh my gosh, Roy's freaking out. I'm sorry, Roy. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Oh, Roy, no. Boy. Come here. Come here.
He's like, why'd you do that?
I know. He's like, oh my god, both of them whistled. Who do I go to?
That thumping noise is his tail smacking against the wall.
Oh my god, I read this thing the other day. This one person said that he had to take his dog to the emergency vet because his dog fractured its tail from wagging it too hard.
Oh. That's the most pure thing I've ever heard.
I know. I read it to Joe and I was like, this is so sweet.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, so we could blame the kushtakas, but we could also blame animals. So I'll cover the suspected animals in this area, but there are a few I'll touch on a little bit more. So you have your typical bears, wolves, moose, so my.
So good.
But there's a show called Alaska Monsters. So this is a show where six experienced frontiersmen called the Alaska Midnight Suns explore the Alaska Triangle to try to find what dangerous beasts are out there. So they investigate the area zone by zone to see what they can find and to see if they can shed light into what is causing all these people to disappear. Mm. So the different zones in the triangle are, like, they have specific names, and these Alaskan Midnight Suns listen to stories of people who claim to have seen or have knowledge of these animals in these zones. So the AMS try to track down and find the animals. So I couldn't find an episode on YouTube, so I watched, like, brief little clips of them. They're like, if you picture Alaska frontiersmen, like, this is what these guys look like. So some of the animals they're hunting are obviously Bigfoot or the Bushman, who's located in what they have dubbed Zone 22, Buffalo Haven. This Bigfoot is believed to be 800 pounds. Oh. The saber wolf, who's located in Zone 21, which is the White Coal Country. This wolf is so massive that folklore claims that it can decapitate its victim's head in a single bite. There's also the kushtaka, which I talked about, who are in Zone 10, the Valley of the Lost Gold. They've investigated the White Death in Zone 15, No Man's Land. So this is a tiger of sorts. It's like this huge beast. Mm-hmm. It has stripes, and their lore is said that every time it kills a human, it gains another stripe on its coat.
Wow.
There's the Hairy Man in Zone 8, Earthquake Alley, the Northern Giant in Zone 24, the Saber Wolf. There's the Windwalker in Zone 20, which is called Denali in the Denali National Park. He's very mean and territorial. Couldn't find any more about this thing. The Toke Yukon Howler in Zone 13, which is the Musher's Paradise. It stalks sled dogs in the middle of winter, so that's like the Iditarod dogs.
Oh, leave them alone.
I know. The Cotch Creek Woodsman in Zone 18, Gold Country. It's reportedly responsible for the unsolved murders in a mining location. There's the Matanuska Klondike Crawler in Zone 9, which is Alaska's breadbasket. Livestock had been turning up slaughtered, and this creature is what they call a knuckle dragger, meaning like an ape kind of thing, and possibly crippled. And these are their words, by the way. And then the Copper Valley Red Devil in Zone 12, which is the Copper River Valley, and it's a Bigfoot that dwells in the trees. So these are all just some of the animals that they believe live in this area and that they're trying to find.
Wow.
And like, it's like your typical thing. They have their, like, blacklight cameras, and they're out at night. They're night vision, and you see them walking, and then, oh my god, they hear this loud crash in the background. Yeah. It's just, it's probably entertaining, but I haven't watched it yet.
You would not catch me doing that in Alaska, though, because if something happened, it would be, like, hours before you got to the hospital.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. So, obviously, we have to cover Bigfoot and Sasquatch.
Yeah.
So, it's easy to see why Alaska would be the perfect place for our furry friend. Millions of acres of wilderness in Alaska and places that are untouched by humans, which would make this an ideal area for Bigfoot to live. Stories of Bigfoot sightings have been reported all across Alaska, which is no surprise, as well as sightings of another creature. It goes by many names like Bushman, Big Man, Tent Monster, Nentina, but most commonly, Yureyuli, which simply translates to hairy man. So this hairy man is said to look very much like the traditional Bigfoot we know, standing between 7 to 10 feet tall, but sometimes as tall as 14 feet. It's covered with shaggy hair and has very ape-like appearances. The Yureyuli has very long arms that hang down to its ankles and also has glowing red eyes. It's a very good swimmer and is usually spotted, as well as its prints, around water. Most of these sightings have been harmless, but in 1930, those sightings became far more sinister. So in the 30s, the small town of Port Chatham began noticing an alarming amount of people going missing, as well as mysterious deaths all occurring around the Kenai Mountains, which is in the Alaskan Triangle. Uh-huh. Andrew Kemluck went out logging, but was later found dead from a blow to the head. A piece of his log moving equipment was ruled as being the murder weapon, but no one to link to this was ever found. Simon Kvasnikov reported that a gold miner he knew had headed out for the day and was never seen again. Another story is from Tom Larson. He was just your average dude, and he went out to chop some wood. He was on the beach setting up fish traps with the wood he had just chopped, and he saw a large hairy being on the beach. He quickly ran home to grab his rifle, and when he returned the beach, the creature was still there.
What if it was just a guy sunbathing?
Well, Larson reported that the creature just stared at him. He didn't end up firing at the monster, which I guess is good, but stated he could not explain why he didn't shoot. Then during World War II, cannery workers went out to hunt sheep and bear near Port Chatham, but never returned. Search parties went out, but no traces of the workers were found. But later, rumors spread that mutilated bodies had been found. The bodies were torn and dismembered, but in such a way that it could not have been a bear attack.
Jeez.
Sightings that include the beast's features have also been reported. So some hunters were out looking for moose. During their search and tracking of this moose, they came across large, man-like footprints, which exceeded 18 inches in length. Before long, the hunters noticed that the big feet were tracking the same animal that they were. Soon, the hunters came upon an area of grass that had been matted down, and it was apparent that a life-or-death struggle had occurred here. But right past the grass, the moose tracks completely disappeared, and the man-like footprints continued on. What I think is so weird is when you talk about Bigfoot as a plural, it's literally big feet. Mm-hmm. I think it's so funny.
Well, there's some big feet coming at us.
I know. In October 2009, the Homer Tribune ran an article that included an interview with one resident from Port Chatham. Melania Helen Kell was born in Port Chatham in 1934. Around this time, and as Melania was growing, she remembers her town being terrorized by the half-man, half-beast that the Eltiki called the Nantinak. Residents of Port Chatham also began to avoid the surrounding forests and would not step foot into the woods. Eventually, the townspeople began leaving the port and moving up the coast. This area had been evacuated once before as well, so in 1905, native workers of the cannery evacuated the area because of something in the woods. Ooh. Though they did return the following year, and then a couple years later, they evacuated again. Though this village is now abandoned, stories have still populated about sightings in and near the town. In 1968, a ghost hunter was out in the area. A goat hunter was out in the area hunting and claimed that he had been chased by a creature. Then in 1973, three hunters were in the area and got stuck in a three-day storm, so they took shelter. They claimed that each night, a creature circled their tents. The creature sounded like it had 2 feet.
Ooh.
And then in 1990, a paramedic from Anchorage was called to the Eagle River Jail just north of the port. He was helping a 70-year-old native man who had suffered a heart attack. While they were talking, the paramedic mentioned that he had been hunting in the Port Chatham area. The elder man suddenly shot up, grabbed the paramedic by the shirt, and asked, "Did it bother you? Did you see it?"
Oh my gosh.
So those are what we have of Bigfoot. All right, Nora, have you heard of the Dogman?
No.
So he is known to live in the remote parts of Alaska, right in the conditions that the Alaska Triangle seems to have. One witness of this dogman comes from a woman named Melissa H. She had been driving home from work in the early hours of the morning. The road stretched between Palmer and Wasilla, which is near our triangle. This is a very dark, rarely traveled road, and it isn't rare to drive for hours without seeing another car. This was about 2 a.m. in October 1998, and Melissa was only about 10 minutes from home. She'd been driving slowly because of the conditions of the road. She said that at one point, her headlights illuminated a dark, tall figure up ahead. It was too slim to be a bear and had, quote, spikes running down its back and neck.
Ugh.
She described the creature as being tall, between 7 and 8 feet, and standing on 2 feet. She said it had a very wolf-like muzzle and large upright ears. The spikes, she described, were actually clumps of its fur. It had a natural-looking curved spine. She didn't see much of its lower body, but said that the upper part had two long legs that had a very dog-like look to them. So picture, like, a dog standing on its back legs with its front arms hanging down. Melissa almost thought that it was a Halloween prop, as it was October, because it didn't look like any animal she had ever seen before. She almost stopped her car to look at the prop until the creature slowly turned its head to look at her. She said that the moment her car lights hit the creature's eyes, she knew it was not a human in a costume and most definitely not a prop. She was able to pull herself out of whatever trance she was in, staring at the creature, and sped away, leaving the monster in the dust.
Oh my gosh. Imagine getting off a work shift. It's the middle of the night, and then you have to deal with that.
Right.
I would be like, are you kidding me?
That's terrifying. And I'd be like, you know what? I'm just not going back to work.
I know. And I'm switching to day shifts.
Yeah, right. God, night shifts. Ugh. And then, of course, we have UFOs. So the main UFO story occurred on November 16th, 1986. A Japanese jumbo freighter aircraft, a Boeing 747, was carrying French wine from Paris to Anchorage.
Very important flight.
Very important. This plane was being manned by a crew of three. All right, I'm going to really not be good at names.
That's okay.
Captain Kenju Tarachi, First Officer Takanori Tamfuji, and Flight Engineer Yoshio Tsukuda. The aircraft reported their position to the Flight Control Center at Edmonton, Alberta, as they were preparing for their descent to the Anchorage Airport. At the time, they were at an altitude of 39,000 feet, which is still the typical altitude that planes fly.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, Captain Tarachi and his crew began noticing that there were unusual white and yellow lights ahead, below, and to the left of them. They had originally thought that these lights had to belong to a military aircraft. When the lights didn't leave their close proximity to the aircraft, First Officer Takanori Tamfuji radioed down to the air traffic control to see if there were any other registered aircrafts in their vicinity.
Mm-hmm.
They were informed that the air control center was only picking up weak signals from the Boeing, but they did see something unidentifiable on their radars that was only about 5 miles away from the airplane. And in the air, that's like super, super close.
Mm-hmm.
The UFOs were described as varying in size. One was about twice the size of the Japanese airliner, where the other two were smaller than the first. He also described the UFO as having a walnut-shaped silhouette, and he estimated it to be 2 times bigger than the aircraft carrier. Mm-hmm. The crew watched these objects on their radar for about 32 minutes. These UFOs were described as disappearing and reappearing rapidly, moving fast but being able to stop quickly, which is something normal airplanes can't do. Captain Tarachi said about the lights, quote, "They were flying parallel and then suddenly appeared very close," end quote. The lights started off in a horizontal position, then moved to a vertical position, then moved to the airport or to the plane's port side, where it remained for most of the ordeal. Then, as the Boeing was flying over Elson Air Force Base, which is near Fairbanks, the captain noticed something large and unusual behind the plane. He described it as a huge mothership. The pilot was given permission to do an emergency landing to try to evade the UFOs, in which he completed a full circle and descended to 31,000 feet, but the UFO followed close behind. So finally, 32 minutes later, the UFO disappeared, but the pilot stated that the whole ordeal felt like it lasted much longer than only 32 minutes. The next night, November 17th, 1986, the FAA and U.S. military ground radar confirmed the sighting of at least one of the UFOs. So they saw something in the air.
Gosh.
Captain Tarachi later gave a more detailed description of the aircraft, saying that, quote, he had spotted yellow, amber, and green lights and a rotating beacon, but no red light. There were two distinct sets of lights, but appeared to be joined together as fixed to one object, end quote. So, like, you know, usually your airplanes are going to have some sort of a red light.
Mm-hmm.
This one just had green, yellow, and amber. So no red lights that a plane would have. He said the plane, like, the lights all looked like they were connected to one object, meaning it's this huge object.
Oh.
Taro Kono, the Japanese defense minister, said that he believed Japan should have a plan for any possible UFO encounters. He says he is not convinced that UFOs exist, but it is clear that pilots encounter unknown flying objects, UFOs, and that his country should have a defense plan in order to deal with, like, whatever those UFOs could be.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of telling.
Yeah.
So these are just a few of the terrifying and scaring things that all happen in the Alaskan Triangle. Definitely not a place I would want to go, and not even a place I would want to fly over.
No, thank you. Especially because a lot of the flights in Alaska are, like, puddle hoppers.
Yeah.
So, puddle hoppers, whatever. You get it.
But yeah, so that's the Alaskan Triangle.
Wow, that's creepy.
I know, but that's, yeah, with your case, how it was so close to it, I was like, oh no, it's kind of creepy.
I mean, it could have been in the Alaska Triangle, but that's very creepy.
Yeah. Well, thanks for listening this week, guys. We really appreciate it, and we appreciate all the kind words we've been getting from some of you guys. It's really nice to hear.
It feels so good. We text each other, like, manic people, like, so excited when we get nice messages, so thank you guys.
I'll be like, oh my god, look at what this person said. It's really, really exciting.
Yeah, it is.
So please, if you guys have any suggestions, just want to chat, have a scary encounter that you've ever had, please email us at ascarystatepodcast@gmail.com.
And please follow us on Instagram and message us if you feel like it. We'll
because
respond.
We love it.
at A Scary State Podcast.
We also have our Facebook. Okay, so I changed it from fan group because I felt weird calling it a fan group. I don't know why. So it's now just A Scary State Podcast on Facebook. Please join, invite all your friends. We would love it.
Yes. Thank you guys. I'm so like excited that we have the Facebook page.
I know. It's really awesome. We'll start posting stuff in there to get like conversations going.
Yeah.
And please rate and review us on iTunes. It's super important to us. We love seeing the ratings. We love seeing the comments.
Yeah, we check it all the time.
It means a lot to us.
All right, guys. Well, stay scary.
Stay safe.
Bye.